doctor said, I have a cure for you, but there's a 99% chance it won't work. And I know you've tried it 5 or 20 times, and it saps your energy, makes you feel worthless, and keeps you stuck in the rest of your life. Would you do it again and again and every year for as long as you live? When you tell the truth, when you see that as much as you say you want to lose weight, you are keeping it on so you don't have to engage in those parts of being alive that seem more challenging than losing weight, you can begin making different decisions about the way you spend your energy. Carolyn Mace, the author of Why People Don't Heal, once said to me, imagine you have a buck of life energy to spend every day. How would you spend it? Start spending that buck differently. Start today, even for 15 minutes. Start living as if you are already free. Skip the middleman of losing weight. Do something, anything, that brings you joy and makes you feel as if you belong here, even for half an hour, even for 15 minutes. If there was a cabal, or if the patriarchy was entrancing women into silence by making them feel awful about their bodies, joy and fearlessness, passion and illuminated hearts would defeat them. And the miraculous thing is that we already have those tools. We just aren't using them. There isn't a someday. There never was. No one has ever been to the future that you keep putting your life on hold for. All we ever have is now. And if you continually put your life on hold for what your life will be like tomorrow or next year, or when you finally lose that weight, you won't recognize that you already have what you want, because you will have spent years training yourself to want, not have. Imagine what you could do, I often ask a group of women, if you stopped turning your energy against yourself and use it instead to question what you've been hypnotized into believing about the size of your body, and to speak up for what matters to you and your children. What would happen if one woman spoke the truth? Asked the poet Muriel Rukeyser. The world would split open, she said. Let that one be you. Chapter 6, The Red String Project. The first day of my final stint in therapy, my therapist asked me to stand across the room from her. Then she started walking toward me and asked me to say, stop, when she got too close. When she was a few inches away, I said, well, maybe you could stop now. Are you paying attention to your body, your center, she asked. I don't have a center the way you're talking about it, and if I do, it's not talking. She told me to think of myself as having energetic boundaries. I rolled my eyes and said that I wasn't sure people had energetic boundaries. Everyone has them, she said. When someone is talking to you and gets uncomfortably close, the discomfort is a sign that your boundary or personal space has been crossed. I nodded my head, still wary but less cynical. A few sessions later, she handed me a small ball of red string. Sit on the floor and use the string to make a circle around yourself. Close the ends together and think of the perimeter as a boundary that no one can cross without your permission. It's your body, she said, your personal space. Yeah, right, I thought, and proceeded to cry, which, burst my cynicism. It's not really mine, I said without knowing what I was saying, and burbled on about my father and how he grabbed my butt, kissed me on the lips, treated my body as if it belonged to him. Although I talked about the grabbing and kissing in other therapeutic situations, my visceral reaction this time convinced me that I'd spent most of my life confused about boundaries and bodies and ownership of both. In my refusal to close the end of the circle, it was immediately clear to me that I believed the consequence of owning this body was losing the love on which my life depended. My body isn't mine, I repeated. That's not how I think of it. Like many men who fought in World War II, my father called women broads. He thought of us as good-looking, mildly dumb, and utterly incapable of greatness. When I brought a friend from Santa Cruz to New York for Thanksgiving, he pinched her butt as we were waiting for our luggage to arrive. As a way to say hello, he murmured, with a satisfied grin, as if he'd just won a trophy for being as suave as Frank Sinatra. Each time I put the string around myself in the following sessions, it was as if an iceberg had turned upside down, and what held it in place was suddenly revealed. I'd say things like, people won't like it, I'll get in trouble, saying no is not allowed. My past experience with my father and a variety of men over the years taught me that my body was a lure to catch their attention. If I used my body or allowed it to be used in ways that were uncomfortable, well, that was the price I needed to pay for intimacy, for connection, for belonging to the tribe. And nothing I saw or heard as I was growing up taught me otherwise. Strange men in subways sometimes masturbated when they looked at me. Other men leered and grabbed me. In my 20s and 30s, I often had sex with men before I really wanted to because I was afraid that if I didn't, they'd go away. It took a few months and a few boxes of Kleenex before I was able to unwind the constellation of beliefs I'd inherited about my body and the feelings associated with them. To sit down in the middle of the circle, close the ends together, and say to my therapist, as she was inching her way across the floor with her string, don't come closer, or I don't want to. A few years after my therapist introduced me to what I call the Red String Project, I decide to try it at my next retreat. On the morning of the third day of our six-day program, a Wednesday, I hand each woman a six-foot piece of red string. I tell them to make a circle around their bodies and to join the ends of the string together. I tell them they're allowed to take up space, that it is their birthright to occupy their own bodies. Before I can finish the instructions, half the room is sobbing. You're wrong, Diana says. I'm not allowed. I turn to look at her. She is tall, at least 6 feet, with a long auburn ponytail, freckled skin, deep-set green eyes, perhaps 50 pounds over her natural weight. She has wrapped her string so tightly around her body that it is practically under her legs. I'll get in trouble if I close the end, she blurts. As I am about to speak to her, I hear a nearby whisper. I'll get in trouble if I even have a string. From the back of the room, Lorianne, a curly-haired, stick-thin, blonde woman, says, can I have another string? One isn't enough. I need to go out in the hall, join the two strings together, and make my circle so big no one can come near. Heads are nodding. Tears are flowing. Wads of Kleenex are being handed out. Delilah from Australia has pink and purple cropped hair, winged black rhinestone glasses, and is wearing a gray T-shirt that says, Chocolate for President. She raises her hand and says, I can't remember my father ever putting a part of him in a part of me, but then again, he didn't have to, because his hands were all over the outside of my body all the time. And he was the good parent. My mother was addicted to alcohol and tranquilizers and spent days in her nightgown, unable to function. If I'd ever told my father to stop touching me, I would have lost the only love I had. They come to the retreat because they have self-identified challenges with food. They are varying degrees of overweight, normal, whatever that is, and underweight. They are capable stay-at-home mothers, psychiatrists, surgeons, CEOs, therapists, singers, actors, television personalities, but give them a red string and the skyscrapers of their lives crumble like Christmas cookies. Give them a red string and it becomes obvious that the issue has never been food, but the ways other people have talked about, touched, and used their bodies, which in turn affects how they talk about and use their own bodies. All that happened in the moment is that, like me, they've been handed a piece of string. Nothing more. But it becomes immediately apparent that most of them, and us, have unconsciously swallowed the rampant misogyny of the culture along with our mashed potatoes. This isn't a problem that only affects a small, self-selected group of retreat-going women. During the November 2016 election, Kelly Oxford requested that women use Twitter to tell stories of their first sexual assaults. 27 million women responded within 24 hours. We can't leapfrog into being free, unencumbered, powerful women just because we want to. Power is not a function of what we do, say, or achieve if it is not also connected to how we live in our physical selves. We can't skip the step of naming what hurt us and questioning how it distorted the ways we treat our bodies. For power to be authentic, the obstacles to it must be named. In this very moment, this means using our senses, feeling our hands, our legs, noticing where there is heat or coolness, pulsing or pressure, hearing the sounds of the room, a person breathing, bringing ourselves back to the present moment so that we have a ground upon which to notice that we are caught in the past. True power lies in our willingness to question the beliefs we swallowed, along with allowing ourselves to feel the rage at those who grabbed or touched us without permission, while staying present and not acting on the desire for revenge. It's possible to feel the full range of our feelings, even hatred. We can see where they are lodged in our chests or throats or faces, and we can allow them to get so big that we are towering with them and breathing fire. If then we keep sensing, feeling, allowing the effects of the past to unfold in us now, we can take ourselves back. If we feel rather than repress or act out our rage or hatred, the undigested feelings in our chest dissolve like a night monster when you turn on the light. That which we could never invite into our awareness because it was too big or too furious or too horrible becomes the source of our power and the guide to effective, authentic action. Hatred is a scary word, a scary feeling for most people, and so we repress it. Or we imagine what would happen if we acted it out. We'd go on a killing rampage. We'd play high-speed bumper cars with the driver who just cut us off. We'd slice off someone's head without blinking. We'd wring the neck of the neighbor's dog that whined all night. At its core, hatred is the desire to annihilate that which is causing us pain, in the misguided belief that if we could only incinerate what seems to be causing the pain, we would finally be at peace. All feuds, all wars, all acts of revenge are built on this principle, including our inner war with food and weight. At my last retreat, many people were furious at my suggestion that they could question the link between the beliefs that resulted from being touched inappropriately and their compulsive eating. One woman said, "I don't like this approach of questioning stories and beliefs. It feels mean and lacking in compassion." My uncle raped me for 3 years, and although I've been working on this in therapy for 20 years, I'm not over it yet. I feel as if you're telling me it's time to let go of something I'm not ready to let go of. A slippery slope indeed. To be clear, I'm not asking anyone to let go of anything, least of all fury or hatred. It's impossible to will yourself to let go of such huge and sticky feelings. I am asking that we feel what we feel instead of think what we feel. Reversing the misogyny of our culture is also an inside job. It happens first by naming the fact that we've internalized it and now treat ourselves with the same lack of respect as the man who grabbed us on the subway. Because it's a lifeless strand and not a present-day situation, because we're acting as if our mothers or fathers or teachers or random men are in the room when many of them are dead and the rest aren't in the room, the red string allows people to see that the immediate reactions they're wedded to are from the past. Which means that embedded in the extra weight we carry around is an unconscious attitude about women's bodies we've inherited. Freeing ourselves from this body hatred means naming the misogyny we've internalized. The most challenging part of respecting our bodies and healing compulsive eating is the conscious decision to question what keeps us bound and silenced. Until we can sit in our own skin and fully occupy the physical space we've been given, we will be apologetic about our bodies. And even when we lose weight because we stuck to a diet, we'll remain frightened of ourselves because we know it's the diet that's keeping us thin, not our own capacity to stay true to what we know or want. On diets, we are still relying on the big, powerful other to know what's best and to save us. And whether it's a good daddy or a good diet that rescues us, we remain victims and food our perpetrator. For a few months, after we complete the Red String Project, which takes repeated practice, some of my students carry their strings in their pockets and imagine putting it around them when they talk to their mothers, fathers, bosses. Many of them make bracelets out of a narrow strand of red leather so they have a visual touchstone of what they've learned. Both are concrete reminders that they can take back their body from the beliefs and people who snatched it and reclaim the capacity to say no or yes or not now. They become centered in their power. Their actions in the world become effective, not reactive. Some students have become political leaders in their hometowns. One works with battered women. Almost all of them realize that although their own mothers did not have the needed understanding to stop rampant body abuse, they do, and they can teach their daughters what they themselves never learned. First, there is one of us, then 50, then 150. Soon we will be a crowd, 200,000, 27 million. We are saying no, and we are saying yes, and whether we whisper or shout, we are saying it together. I can hear you. Chapter 7. In the End. In the end, the point of losing weight is not to lose weight. It's not to get into a pair of size 6 jeans, eat chocolate every day, or have cantaloupe buns. Which isn't to say that any or all of these aren't sublime here on the physical plane where we muddle around day after day. They are. But in the world you cannot see, touch, eat, losing weight and joy are unrelated. Everyone who has lost weight knows this, but we keep forgetting it when we gain weight so that we can once again look forward to an imaginary, happy future. Also, participating in the cycle of judging and shaming ourselves, followed by feeling accomplished and elated, gives us something to do and talk about, a way to pass the time. There's nothing wrong with this pattern. It's how our minds work. We intuitively understand that we want something we cannot see or touch, but we don't know how to name or access it. And so we fall back into believing that being thinner will right everything that's wrong. The only problem is that it's based on a lie. The first time I caught on to the lie, I was 28. I just gained 80 pounds in 2 months, effectively doubling my weight after having spent a few years as an 82-pound anorexic. The fattest I'd ever been, I finally realized I'd been thin many times and it had never fulfilled its promise, and that the emphasis on body size was a hoax. The next morning, I started on a 2-week regimen of eating raw chocolate chip cookies punctuated with daily doses of polar bear pumpkin ice cream. I figured that if being thinner wasn't going to make me happy, and if depriving and shaming myself had no benefit, why do it? Why not eat cookie dough instead? This is how many of us spend our lives, eating the equivalent of cookie dough, then dieting, then eating cookie dough, then dieting. We understand in a remote part of ourselves that we want something we cannot see or touch, but we don't know how to name or access it. And so we fall back into believing that being thinner will right everything that is wrong. Modern dancer and choreographer Martha Graham wrote, "There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all of time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. Since that uniqueness needs a vehicle of expression, and since the vehicle we've been given is our bodies, we do what we can to keep the channel open. When you stuff or starve it, your body shuts down. It cannot reveal its purpose or creativity or wisdom to you. Also, no one wants to listen to a burping, farting channel. It's uncomfortable to walk around in a body that is uncomfortable. It's hard to let innate brilliance or power express itself when you are schlepping around 20 or 50 extra pounds. It's not impossible, just more difficult. And since there is already so much inherent difficulty in being alive, what with people getting sick, raising kids, dying, and the earth on the verge of destruction, why not make life easier on yourself? Why not make the effort to discover what enhances your aliveness and vitality? Because when you do, you become less and less fascinated with those foods, activities, and people that don't. In my mind, there is only one true reason to lose weight: to keep the channel open. You think the pain is about the 20 pounds that's separating you from fitting into your jeans, but that's the crux of the lie, as all those people on their deathbeds will tell you. Google people, regrets, deathbeds, and read about the 5, 27, or 35 things they say. Their regrets, without exception, are about allowing themselves to get distracted by some form of the lie. The Indian sage Nisargadatta writes that all teachings, whatever their source, have only one aim: to save you from the calamity of a separate existence, of being a meaningless dot in a vast and beautiful picture. In some part of ourselves, we know this. We know that what we're doing on this earth is manifesting spirit in the only physical vehicle we've been given, our body. By doing so, we're saving ourselves from the calamity of leaving the earth without showing up. Eventually, we become more dedicated to keeping the channel open than to eating meatloaf when we're not hungry. And although we keep faltering, keep slipping, keep being seduced by the lie, one day we will be more drawn to the truth than to the endless fascination with drama, pretty things, and thinner thighs. The only best reason to do this, to keep the channel open, is that there, in that vast space, we find love itself, flagrant, unstinting, give-it-all-away love. Not just for our spouses or children or particular community, but for arms and legs and night and fog, love for the mornings, floors, caterpillars, and trees. Love for the sounds your foot makes on the sidewalk, for traffic and honking horns, for the earth itself. Nothing is left out. Zen teachers call it discovering your original face. We do whatever it takes to keep the channel open, because when we don't, it hurts, and when we do, it doesn't. Also, there is nothing better to do with the life. Part 2. Through the Mind. Chapter 8. Zen Mind, Puppy Mind. We adopted a puppy last week, and it hasn't been pretty around here. Well, really, it hasn't been pretty in here. My mind, that is. Izzy the puppy, however, is pretty. She looks like a stuffed toy. Big brown eyes and a nose like a plump olive. Red fur that is soft and a bit curly. My friend Catherine says she looks like a person impersonating Lucille Ball. Cute little puppy running around with her black pawda stuffed purse. From the outside, you'd think that her house was the picture of adorableness. Then you might take a look at my face and see that there's trouble in paradise. Izzy was a sort of rescue dog. Sort of because she wasn't supposed to be a rescue. My husband and I aren't that virtuous. I know, it's terrible. And if I had a tail, it would be between my legs. Good-hearted people, people who care about the earth, do not buy dogs. I, however, am not one of those people. Don't get me wrong. I give money every year to Save Aceto, the Marin Humane Society, and Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. I believe that the people who save dogs and the people who adopt those dogs are angels. I, it must now be apparent, am not an angel. Plus, almost everyone I know who has adopted rescue dogs. Okay, three people. None of my other friends are silly enough to even get a dog, and I understand their feelings much more this week than last week, told us that it's taken 2 years for their dogs to stop submission peeing and fear biting. I don't want to wait 2 years. I'm already 65. I don't want to spend the time I have left, not even 2 years of it, with a submissively peeing dog. So we decided to buy a puppy, a four-legged fluff of jubilation. We looked at a litter of 9, all of which were like those irresistible puppies you see on YouTube. All that is, except for one that was cowering in the corner. She was shaking and frightened and couldn't get away from the bully that kept attacking her. She wouldn't walk over to us. She wouldn't make eye contact with us. And in a moment of weakness, a moment of remembering what it felt like to be the chubby kid who never got picked for soccer, but did get picked on by Peter Zimmerman, the class bully, my heart melted. And so when Matt said, "If we don't take her, I don't think anyone else will," I agreed. Until last week, I would have told you that I like animals more than people. I am an animal person, I say, when people start talking about babies and puppies. After it rains, I spend hours saving salamanders and frogs from getting run over. The hummingbirds in my backyard land on my fingers. And I, who a poor being wet or cold, have been known to jump into icy bodies of water to save drowning baby birds. I fancy myself like Clarissa Estes in Women Who Run With the Wolves. I could be wild enough to run with very nice wolves, or at least capable of loping with a poodle. Izzy, by the way, is a standard poodle. But today I am not an animal person. Today I don't like anything on four legs, especially the one that looks like Lucille Ball. I blame my husband. He, Matt, is the one who wanted a dog. And not just any dog. He wanted a girl dog. A big, non-shedding girl dog, and this is the important part, that was related through a complicated series of bloodlines to Celeste, our dog that died a year ago. Me? I was enjoying not having a pet for the first time in 18 years, enjoying being able to walk out the door and not see those big eyes staring at me through the window, silently accusing me of abandonment. But Matt also has big doggy eyes, and when he looked at me ever so sweetly and said, "I really want a dog now," I caved in. I'm usually not a pushover, but, and I say this in the kindest possible way, Matt is very dog-like. Every morning he greets me like he hasn't seen me for 10 years. "Hi, sweetheart," he says brightly. Big smile, crinkly eyes, like the sun is just now rising and using his face as its stage. Sometimes I am glum, introverted, and rather dramatic, sort of like Isadora Duncan. Was her nickname Izzy, who was strangled to death by her own scarf. So as Matt walked around shaking off sparks of light while telling me how much he wanted a puppy, I thought, well, it doesn't seem right to deprive him, and anyway, why not get a dog? I am, after all, an animal person. But today I'm convinced we made a huge mistake. Izzy walks around when she's willing to come out from under the bed, with her tail down, afraid of everything, doorways, stuffed toys, food, water, friends, Matt, me. Last week, a woman who started a sanctuary for abused and abandoned dogs came over to help bring Izzy out of her shell. After 3 hours, she said, "Your dog is as bad as any feral dog I've ever met." This from a person who rescues dogs thrown over bridges in Mexico City. This from the woman who drives around with 10 feral dogs in her car, most of whom look like large rats. "If I was going to get a dog," I'd say to my husband, and apparently the "if" part of that sentence is now moot, "I want a dog that's happy. I want a dog that could remind me that day-to-day joy is possible." I tell him about my friend Nina's nephew, who spent a year searching for a puppy, adopted one, and within a week decided he wasn't cut out to be a puppy father. I tell him the story of the writer Joyce Maynard, who adopted two girls from Ethiopia, soon realized it was a mistake, and gave them back, i.e. found them a home with two stable parents. "If people can give back their children," I tell Matt, "I can give back a puppy. Can we please just FedEx Izzy back to where she came from?" But, and I'm now going to get to the point of this story, I began to see that living on the inside of my mind, or rather believing the things my mind regales me with regularly, is like chewing nails. For instance, the night before I married Matt, I was convinced I was gay and was marrying a man because I lacked the courage to come out. 12 hours before walking down the aisle, I was suddenly beset with memories of my wild attraction to Rose Coven in 8th grade and the downy pleasure of feeling each other's breasts, which were a bit like large mosquito bites, on the orange pillows in my bedroom. After confiding this to my friend Sill, she reminded me that although I'd had many opportunities to be with women since eighth grade, I really did prefer the smell and feel of men, particularly the one I was marrying the next day. For the longest time, I clung to the conviction that scary thoughts are created by scary situations. Losing someone you love, being fired, having your house burned down, being diagnosed with a terminal illness. I couldn't tell the difference between my stories of a situation and the situation itself. When I believe my stories, I'm convinced I'm living the wrong life. And I found that without the stories, there is a simplicity and an elegance to life as it is unfolding in this very moment. With Izzy, because the stakes are somewhat lower than marrying a person of the wrong sex or being diagnosed with a terminal illness, I see that although having a dog whose nervous system reminds me of my own wouldn't be my first choice, there is something about this dog that I feel as if I already know. Almost, but not exactly, as if I'd been waiting for her, and there she was, but not in the dog costume I was expecting. Therefore, with uncharacteristic maturity, I have made a promise to stop myself whenever I notice I am listening to the stories my mind prattles on about. Since I could switch the Izzy story with many similar tales I've told myself that were not true, it has once again become quite clear to me that, as spiritual teacher Catherine Ingram says, the mind is mad. When I remind myself of that, I don't take the thoughts that I need a different dog, life, husband personally. The truth is that along with its multiple and exhilarating pleasures, there is something deeply uncomfortable about being human, about loving for the sake of it, even when you know that everything and everyone you love is going to get lost, get broken, or die, particularly four-legged beings that almost always die before you. When I first met Matt, he was grieving the loss of his previous partner, who'd been diagnosed with ovarian cancer 6 months after they met and died 5 years later. Despite knowing her for only 182 days, I counted, he accompanied her through 4.5 years of chemotherapy treatments, hair losses, excruciating pain, 3 remissions, and the dying process. "But you just met," I thought. "How could you willingly go through that kind of heartbreak and loss? Why didn't you just leave?" Never mind that after knowing him for 20 minutes, I felt as if I could go swimming in the ocean of his heart. It was that big. Or that when I heard he'd stayed with his partner, I realized that he was a man who loved with fierceness and loyalty, and I liked that, even if I didn't understand it. When I finally asked him why he stayed, he said he understood that the pain of losing her would be so much less than the pain of never having loved her at all. As the weeks have rolled along, the situation with Izzy has changed, as situations always do. She's kissing us now, puts her wet truffle nose in the crook of my neck every morning to be nuzzled. Despite my reluctance, I find myself laughing at her prance-prance leap before she picks up a toy and the crossing of her paws when she lies down, as if awaiting high tea and scones. The way she lives in the world, as any animal person knows, is a portal to what the Zen masters call beginner's mind. Everything is new to her, even the scent of the redwood tree she's passed a few hundred times. Despite her hypervigilant nervous system, she's a constant reminder that although I've seen the tree in our driveway, the succulents in our garden, the helicopter flight of the hummingbirds 100,000 times, I haven't seen them today. And according to Zen masters and dogs, there is no other day. No one has ever touched or experienced the future, because when it arrives, it is still only today, which makes it a perfect day to revel in the spectacle of being above ground and throwing a pink elephant toy across the room dozens of first times. Chapter 9. Be kind to the ghost children. Izzy has an eating disorder. When I put her food bowl down, she looks at me as if it's a couch, as if the fact that she's supposed to eat it hasn't occurred to her. My cat Blanche also had a problem with food. He was so fat that when he sat on your head in the middle of the night, you felt as if your brain was being crushed. And there was Celeste, our dog before Izzy, who was allergic to dog food and could only eat white rice, chicken breasts, and egg yolks for the first 3 years of her life. No, it has not escaped my purview that 100% of the animals that live with us manifest extreme food symptoms. Matt and I take Izzy to a vet that my friend Annie tells me about. She says Rob the vet is a miracle worker. She also says that coincidentally, all of her animals have had eating disorders too. She puts coincidentally in capital letters and tells me that Rob the vet worked with Coco the gorilla. At the mention of Coco, I swoon. Although I have tried to visit Coco in Palo Alto for years, she adopted a homeless kitten and was friends with Robin Williams, I have not been able to arrange a meeting. Rob the vet has startling ice blue eyes and palomino hair that drifts like crazy wings down his collar. On his walls are the requisite letters from kids written in big crayon rainbow colors. Dear Dr. Rob, thank you for saving Lucy. She wasn't feeling so good. Love, Miranda. Dear Dr. Rob, even though Bongo has one eye, I love him better than my brother. Thank you for helping him. Love, Mandy. During our first session, Rob tells us that Izzy, who is a year and a half, has no belly center. Actually, he says, she has no abdomen content. She is in the throes of a shock pattern from being abused, attacked, and bullied for the first 12 weeks of her life, which, according to him, are the most formative. Then Rob proceeds with his specialty, the psychomotor treatment, which consists of different kinds of massages on her spine, in her joints, on her head, coupled with looking deep into Izzy's eyes and holding her close to his belly. Do you want to try it? He asks us. I nod, then look at Matt to see if he'd like to go first, but since relaxing is not a challenge for him, he's taken this opportunity to nap. Rob asked me to stand belly to belly with him and to breathe. Although it does feel somewhat comforting to lean against a big belly, what gets to me, what really makes an impression, is that he keeps emphasizing that Izzy will be fine, that she can learn to regulate herself, and that it is me who needs to relax. Are you a nice person? He asks me. I'm about to launch into the many ways in which I am cranky and selfish when Rob says, I don't really need to know the circumstances in which you aren't nice, just a general impression of whether you are kind to your animals. I nod and tell him that my teacher Jean says that in her next life she is coming back as my dog. Rob says, then she has enough of what she needs, food, water, space to run, kindness, and she'll be fine. Relax, he says. She'll discover her own relationship with food, but you have to hold the line. You can't let her manipulate you with those big eyes and her history of abuse and abandonment. Now he's talking. I am a sucker for tales of abuse and abandonment, mine and others. Being abused served me in many ways, although I would not have chosen it, and it gave me a story to tell in my first few books. Also, writing about people who hurt you is an excellent way to take revenge, but only people who aren't nice would know that. And it provided the longing to see what, if anything, lay beyond a life of drowning myself in fried chicken and coffee ice cream. Because, Rob continues, she's been living with you for a year and a half now, many times longer than the 3 months in which she was abused, and being frightened of food or people means she's living in the past, not the present. Unless you muster equal parts kindness and fierceness with her, the stance of having been abused and what she is able to get from you because of it will become a way of life. I am listening intently but can no longer figure out whether he's talking about Izzy or me, because although abuse and how I used food to dull its pain became a portal for me, it also provided a solid identity of being the wounded one who survived. Having spent years in therapy and written books about what happened, there is a teeny chance that I began wearing the wounds as adornments, as my calling card. You think you had it tough? You think you had a difficult childhood? Read my book, When Food is Love, and get back to me. Rob interrupts my thoughts and says, I think I can help her. Come once a week for 6 weeks, and let's see how it goes. As I've worked with my students about what happens in the moment before they eat compulsively, I've come to realize that each of us plays host to at least two or three distinct identities that, when triggered, feel utterly familiar. They feel like who we actually are. We feel rejected or sad or lonely, and in a flash, we shapeshift. Then we begin telling ourselves stories. This always happens. They always leave. I will always be alone. I need to eat. And because we've told ourselves those same things for many years, we believe they're true. The familiarity of the feelings and the fact that they keep repeating themselves in many different situations means, it seems, that the stories and who we take ourselves to be in them are who we really are. In my retreat work, we call these historical familiar identities the ghost children. Some of us, most of us, don't just have one ghost child. We have a series of well-worn but incredibly painful selves whose skins we inhabit as easily as we slip on old ratty coats from the back of the closet. Some of us, I won't mention names, are running daycare centers for ghost children. Listening to and believing these voices is partly responsible for the urge to eat when we're not hungry. One of my retreat students is sobbing. She's been in a relationship for 6 months with someone, she says, who loves her. She says it's the first time in her life, she is 32, that she is loving and being loved by someone who doesn't abuse her. When I saw her 6 months ago, before she met her lover, she looked vibrant and joyful. Now, she says, all she can do is eat and eat. I come home from work every night, and I walk straight to the refrigerator. I open it, I dive into it, as if it was my last chance at survival. Then I spend the night binging. Through a gush of tears, she tells me that all I know of love is loss. Really, I ask? All you know is loss? Yes, she says, and cries louder, harder. We both know that what she is saying isn't true, because in order to have survived this long, she would have needed what psychologists call good enough love. We also know that she has spent 5 months being with someone who understands and cherishes her. But her experience at this moment is subsumed by a ghost child, by the one who was abused, the one who wasn't seen or cherished. And although there are many feelings that have become associated with love, loss, fear, abuse, shame, abandonment, they are not true in this moment. Nonetheless, those feelings are present, and it is not helpful to push them away or tell her to snap out of it and grow herself up. But neither would it serve her to believe that what she's saying is true. After a while, the stories from our past begin to feel like poems we memorized in fifth grade or Beatles songs we learned by heart. They evoke memories, feelings, possibilities, or the lack of them. And if we believe them, we are defined by them. It's as if we draw a circle around ourselves and say, this is me. This is what I am capable of. This is how it will be forever. Instead of being kind to the ghost children, instead of treating them as Rob urged me to treat Izzy, with a combination of kindness toward the pain and fierceness about not being manipulated by it, we either try to get rid of them or we become them. Either way, it's like living on the inside of a scream from 20, 30, 50 years ago. Another story from a retreat. It's 8 a.m., breakfast time, and more than 100 of us are gathered in the dining room of the retreat center. The room is steamy and hot from bodies and coffee and mounds of scrambled eggs. 13 tables of 8 fill the room. I stand on the side, ready to speak to anyone who's curious about the amount or kind of food she's put on her plate. Since most of us use food in secret by rationalizing why, just this once, we deserve to have this pancake cinnamon bun cake, otherwise we will die, being in a crowded room with your plate piled with food and being asked to pay attention is like wearing your insides on the outside. There is nowhere to hide. A woman named Barry raises her hand. She has large brown eyes, short, cropped gray hair, and is perhaps 75 pounds over her natural weight. I weave my way through the space between the chairs and stand beside her right shoulder. She starts to cry immediately, stops after a few moments, and looks down at her plate. It is piled high with eggs, 3 pieces of toast, mounds of potatoes, and 2 cinnamon buns. I've taken enough food to feed 3 people, she says. Yes, I say, it seems you have. I wonder who or what you are feeding. Without missing a beat, she says, my mother died this year and I miss her so much I can't stand it. The grief is too much. It's too much. She starts to cry again. Then she says, I try taking my cat for a walk on a leash and he didn't want to go, so he just bent over, laid on the ground, and wouldn't get up. I feel like my cat. I don't want to get up. I just want to eat. I ask Barry how old she feels. 10 years old, and I've lost my mom, and there's nothing I can do to bring her back. I can't handle this by myself. I'll fall apart if I let myself feel it. And what will food do? Fill the hole left by my mom. And how's that working? I ask. She stops crying and a giggle escapes. Not so well. I've gained 40 pounds and my mom hasn't come back. I'm afraid I'll get swallowed by the grief, so I keep eating to make it go away. And now, I ask, what about right now? Now I feel sad. Where in your body do you feel that? I ask. In my chest, in my stomach. It feels heavy, like a dark, dense cloud. And what happens if you stay with the feelings instead of pushing them away by eating? Well, she answers, when I feel the sadness itself, it feels dark but also soft. It feels heavy but also warm. I don't feel like my cat anymore. I just feel heavy, warm, soft, and dark. But I also feel something else. A tenderness towards it. And the food on your plate, how do you feel about that? Like it could feed me and a small army, like I don't want it anymore. People come to my retreats to get rid of their issues with food. They want peace, they want release, and they want it by the end of the week-long retreat. I understand the urgency. I know that what they really want, and it does feel urgent, is to be free from what tortures them, from all the voices that tell them they're not good enough, from what prompts them to eat when they're not hungry, from the suffering of a lifetime. I was waiting most of my life for that, and I believed, really believed, that the freedom and the joy I imagined would come with it existed as a destination, like a balmy tropical island where Brazilian bikini waxes were outlawed and piña coladas were free. If only I could skip over the painful parts. If only I wasn't myself. Just last week, I was back to thrashing around in ghost stories. I'm a failure. I'm dying of cancer of something that hasn't yet been discovered. I'm too needy. My needs are repulsive. And the feelings that accompany them, depression, emptiness, and loneliness. I call it my pig pen state. According to Peanuts, pig pen travels in his own private dust storm, knowing full well that he has affixed to him the dust of ages. The next day, I realized I was swinging between two familiar poles, moping around in my own private dust storm and losing patience with the moping. Then I remembered that this process of discovery used to take weeks, and I also recalled that I can make a choice. I can decide to step out of my stories and turn toward the feelings directly. Turning toward myself in that moment feels like the very opposite of what any normal person would do, which is to run screaming in the opposite direction and toward the ice cream. It feels like I am choosing to die, and in some ways I am, because when I turn toward myself, the old me story dissolves. The gaggle of ghost children, the worthlessness and shame and beliefs about how I or we should be, could be, should have been, are based on elaborate stories about why what happened happened. For many reasons, we could not feel the hurt or pain or abandonment at the time it arose, 20 or 30 or 50 years ago. So we keep feeling it now in the form of frightened, ashamed, unlovable ghost children. The choice now is whether we keep believing in and reinforcing those images in our minds or whether we stop, whether we retreat into old stories each time we feel rejected or whether we turn toward that well of beliefs and the pain that accompanies them and allow them to speak. This turning toward is the very definition of kindness. When on that pig pen morning of my discontent, I stopped clenching against the pain, i.e., believing my thoughts about how awful I was, I remembered an interaction I'd had a few days before with a friend who seemed to be withdrawing from our relationship, and I slowly realized I was blaming myself for wanting too much. And since a version of that interaction happened many times over many years, why do you always need? Can't you think of anyone but yourself? I began seeing myself the way I believed other people saw me, as repulsive, as wanting too much, as an open wound. That morning, I decided that instead of being disgusted by Pigpen, I'd invite him in. And then everything hurt, my skin, my feet, my chest. Without my mind stories about the hurt, oh my God, this will never end. What if I can't ever get off the bed? It became a red pulsing sensation in the back of my chest. And as I allowed it to be there, it changed. First it softened, and then it spread like a wave into my arms and down my belly. Tears came. I could feel my childhood confusion, the way I shrank to fit the space I thought my family could tolerate. And then came tenderness. For the child who couldn't get enough of her mother, and for the mother who couldn't take being wanted by her child. for the situation itself. Poor Pigpen, I thought. And in that moment, I wasn't young and I wasn't old. I wasn't crazy and I wasn't lonely. I was both the pain